Lupus and scleroderma. It isn't quite fair to lump these two very important diseases together in a single category, and this should not be construed as an attempt to do so. And yet there are some streams of striking similarity that run between the two. In the first place, they are both branded with that cursed epithet etiology unknown. Both involve impaired collagen formation in the skin and a challenged ability of the erythematic layer to rebuild itself. And both are believed to be systemic diseases with dramatic, unsightly, and often terrible manifestations on the skin. And more than occasionally, both diseases in their latter stages can prove fatal. In fact, so traumatic and devastating are these afflictions, and so fatalistically challenged are many of their victims, that nationwide lupus and scleroderma support groups have been set up just to assist sufferers in their moments of despair. For these groups and all sufferers of both diseases, there is hope. It is called aloe vera. And though I regret the fact that more clinical laboratory research has not been done to examine aloe's effects against these dread diseases, I am happy to say I have been privy to virtually dozens of cases of each in which those driven down by these diseases have risen up to lead normal lives again by virtue of the introduction of one element that has changed their lives, the silent healer, aloe vera. In numerous cases, both medical practitioners and the individuals themselves have reported that properly apportioned intakes of aloe vera combined with topical applications, as recommended by their therapist, have served not only to alleviate these conditions but also to reverse their effects. Since they stem from disparate sources, it would be difficult to cover each case individually. What I would like to do is cover two exceptional cases, one each, of these dread diseases and how they were not only helped but completely turned around by aloe vera. In so doing, we admit a certain inclination toward the dramatic, yet there's no better way to illustrate the obvious. If aloe can work to treat conditions as severe as these, one can easily make the translation to understand what they can do with instances of disease that are closer to the median. Bilateral scleroderma, the Monty Hayner story. Technically, scleroderma is a disease in which localized edema of the skin is characterized by hardening, atrophy, deformity, and ulceration. Scleroderma victims are actually dealing with such blocked collagen formation that the skin actually becomes hardened, loses all elasticity, crusts up, hardens, and literally chips away to reveal ulcerated skin beneath. The condition is usually degenerative, and ordinarily treatments like steroids that have positive short-term implications are ineffectual and even counterproductive over protracted periods of time. It is often most visible on the body's lower limbs, but it can show up on the face, hands, and fingers. In its advanced stages, scleroderma attacks the body's organs, often causing them to harden. This eventually renders them unable to function. When this happens, death can and often does result. The reference to bilateral simply means that the sufferer is experiencing the condition bilaterally or on both sides of his or her body. This was the syndrome Monty J. Hayner of Shreveport, Louisiana, faced when we were first presented with his case in 1976. By the time a report of the case had reached me, it was already in an advanced stage. Mr. Hayner's dermatologist, Dr. Albert Irving Clark, had already tried every known therapy to treat the syndrome. Wet casts, topical applications of honey, Biozyme, Grandulex, Gold Leaf, steroids, and numerous other treatments, both ordinary and bizarre, had been tried. Nothing had worked. The condition continued to worsen to such an extent that some ulceration had penetrated all the way to the bone. Dr. Clark's consultation with other specialists proved fruitless, and despite every effort to save him, Monty Hayner was now given scant prognosis for recovery. Before long, the scleroderma condition had degenerated to such a painful and pronounced degree, Dr. Clark began to fear that Mr. Hayner might take his own life. Such occasions were by no means rare. As it turned out, quite the contrary proved to be true. Instead of succumbing to despair, Monty Hayner took charge of his own destiny and returned to Dr. Clark with reports of an exceptional new treatment, stabilized aloe vera. At the time, Dr. Clark remembers, I frankly felt we were facing a hopeless situation and would have tried anything, even manure, if I thought it would have helped this man's condition. Given the time and place, and the relative lack of professional awareness of aloe vera's broad-spectrum uses in the mid-70s, we were considered something of a last resort. Nevertheless, Dr. Clark contacted me, and I recommended a strict topical aloe vera regimen that included an aloe gel-based poultice around Mr. Hayner's legs for at least 8 hours. After that, an aloe vera cream was to be added for the remainder of the day. Additionally, Mr. Hayner was to drink at least 8 ounces a day of an aloe vera drinking gel to help cleanse and purify his system. Monty Hayner began his stabilized aloe vera regimen in July 1976. After weeks in the hospital, he was delighted to report that he noticed positive results almost immediately. By late September, he reported to Dr. Clark that much of the area had healed, and he was walking again. By early December, just 5 months after he started the regimen, he reported that healing was taking place in every aspect of his condition. By September 1977, both Monty Hayner and Dr. Clark were happy to report a virtually complete heal. Only one ulcer remained on one leg, about the size of a dime. Understandably, consulting physicians marveled at Monty Hayner's recovery and were left with little choice other than to declare his complete remission as having been phenomenal, if not miraculous. In his final report, Dr. Clark was effusive in his evaluations, as his sentiments in this letter expressed to me. I can only say that the use of aloe vera has cured this man of the severe ulcerations that went with his bilateral scleroderma. When I consider the fact that Mr. Hayner also has diabetes, hypertension, elevated cholesterol, and rheumatoid arthritis as concomitant diseases, I can wholeheartedly state without any equivocation that the only thing that healed extensive ulcerations of the lower extremities was the use of aloe vera supplied by Mr. Coates, which cured this man of the severe pains of scleroderma. Very truly yours, Albert Irving Clark, M.D., Shreveport, Louisiana. The Monty Hayner case was pivotal for a number of reasons. First, in an era when aloe vera was viewed even by learned medical colleagues as having effect only in topical treatment, we were able to show that this healing plant worked both inside and outside the system. Second, it broke down some barriers against aloe vera, especially in treating victims of scleroderma. We're happy to say, due to the courage of people like Monty Hayner and physicians like Dr. Albert Irving Clark, aloe has become a treatment of choice for some practitioners to meet the challenges of this dread disease. Lupus, the Rita Thompson story. Lupus, often referred to as lupus erythematosus, is one of the most insidious, systemically pervasive, and hard-to-treat syndromes known to modern medicine. It manifests in two forms: systemic lupus erythematosus, SLE, and discoid lupus erythematosus. Of the two, the systemic lupus is far more serious in that it is completely pervasive through the system and can be fatal. Unmistakably, lupus is degenerative, and in its later stages extends into most of the body's organs. Yet it makes itself evident on the skin in unsightly rashes and blemishes only after the condition has advanced well beyond symptomatic confusion. This makes the manifestations doubly difficult to treat because by then some of the immune system's defenses have already short-circuited. In fact, part of the challenge of lupus is a possible overproduction of the body's immune system responses. Too many good guys rushing to do the job against antigens and creating a negative force all their own. Another of the challenges in systemic lupus is that initially it is very difficult to diagnose, and since aches and pains are a part of the early package, it is often confused with rheumatoid arthritis. Lupus, like scleroderma, has no apparent causal parent, which makes it doubly difficult to treat, although certain medicines, excessive exposure to the sun, and high-fat, high-processed junk food diets seem to set it off. And like scleroderma today, there has been some positive effect obtained from administering massive doses of high antioxidant complexes such as vitamin C, E, A, especially beta-carotene, selenium, coenzyme Q10, L-glutamine, and pycnogenol, as well as aloe vera. This, however, is 1997. Rita Thompson was privy to none of that information in 1975 when she was first diagnosed with this horrendous disease. Actually, at the time, so little was known about lupus, she was originally diagnosed as having rheumatoid arthritis and was treated accordingly by her physician. For the next 5 years, the aches and pains continued, as did the misdiagnosis. In fact, Rita remembered, it was the early stages of my lupus. It wasn't until mid-year 1980 that the lupus appeared cutaneously, and it did so as a series of measles-like lesions, appearing first on her legs as a slight irritation. They lasted only about 2 weeks and appeared to get better. Unfortunately, one of the most insidious qualities of lupus is its apparent capacity for spontaneous remission, only to reappear later in an even more wretched manifestation. Such was the case with Rita Thompson. Within a few days of appearing to get better, more lesions appeared on her legs, to be sure, and on the rest of her body as well. Only this time the lesions didn't go away. They worsened and persisted for 2.5 years. During that time, Rita Thompson underwent an ordeal few people could endure. The lupus rashes, already pervasive, were perennial and slowly worsening. Even more demoralizing was the fact that every time they appeared to get better, they would in fact become even worse. Not surprisingly, her condition deteriorated to such an extent that she was hospitalized frequently, and her skin trauma was treated with every conventional modality of healing. Topical creams, special wraps, solution soakings, and some fairly radical therapies. For systemic implications, she received pill prescriptions by the dozens, none of which worked. In fact, no therapies at all worked to alleviate anything. What's more, these were the early days of lupus awareness, so her infirmity went misdiagnosed for nearly a decade. Finally, the condition advanced to such a state that she was able to wear no clothing at all, but instead had to be kept in a plastic wrap lubricated with special solutions. Eventually, she was treated by a rheumatologist who prescribed a radically strong steroidal tandem of creams and capsules to be taken in mega doses. This was a sort of shock therapy and, as it turned out, couldn't have been worse. Those who treat the disease on a regular basis have found to their dismay that lupus erythematosus has one of the strongest bounce-back factors of any disease known to science. And one of the worst things you can do is prescribe a strong regimen and then withdraw it. This was the case with this doctor's regimen. And in fact, Rita's condition became even more severe. By now, Rita had lost her hair, her fingernails, and was told there was little chance of either growing back. One of her attending physicians later confided that by this time he had given her no more than 2 months to live. So grave had her condition become. Never underestimate the resolve and resourcefulness of a patient with the will to live and a faith in her ability to recover. Rita Thompson soon set out to be an agent in her own cure, and when she had heard of the benefits of aloe vera, started using a regimen of products I had formulated, specifically aloe vera drinking gel. To dramatize the significance of the systemic aspect of lupus, this gel was the only application of aloe Rita took, moderate doses at first, then megadoses later when she realized how quickly and rapidly her condition had begun to improve. Met with both incredulity and scientific curiosity by her attending physicians, Rita was encouraged to quit taking the aloe gel just to see if the skin lesions would recur, but Rita was steadfast in her refusal. "I know it is the aloe vera," she insisted. But the test, it seemed, would befall her in any case. One time, quite by accident, Rita Thompson ran out of her supply of aloe vera drinking gel and was told it would be 2 days until she could get another shipment. Within that 2 days' time, the lupus symptoms returned. Her body started to break out in lesions, and the pain recurred. Once the new supply arrived and Rita was able to resume drinking the gel, her system normalized and the lesions again disappeared. So dramatic was Rita Thompson's recovery and so strong her intent to give others hope and show them the aloe pathway to remission that she penned a short book entitled Lupus, Aloe Vera, and Me. It is recommended reading for anyone who wants to learn about what one person in the face of all odds can do to take charge of his or her life, health, and future. Rita Thompson is a remarkable woman, and we are glad we could have had some small part in helping her find a new life and a new wellness lifestyle. Update. Progress comes in many forms, and sometimes we must all accept that the complex tapestry of disease and cure cannot be tied together by a single thread. Aloe vera can do so many things. It cannot do everything. No curative or treatment can. Nevertheless, I can reaffirm that in my personal experience, it has helped lupus and scleroderma victims by the score in many ways, some of them to the point of total remission. Others, it has helped as a viable palliative, often the only palliative. That by no means implies that aloe vera is the whole answer. Despite a great deal of headway against these pernicious and persistent diseases, they continue to strike more people every year. Perhaps it is the age of the supervirus that spawns their continued proliferation. At least we take solace in the realization that diagnostics and treatment for these conditions are rising to meet the challenge with both better information and improved modalities of treatment. Still, they persist, so much so that, as I mentioned earlier, there are now lupus and scleroderma support groups rising throughout the nation. Recently, we have been working with one of them in a control group study to show how the use of aloe vera cream topically on their hands can help reduce the degrees of infection, relief of scaling, cracking, and ulceration. The results of this study were exceptional and led us to another use for aloe in treating both lupus and scleroderma victims. One of the most insidious and debilitating concomitant effects of these conditions is the impact it makes literally to stiffen and nearly ossify certain mucous membranes of the body cavity. Especially in scleroderma victims, but in lupus sufferers as well, the simple digestion of food and drink becomes a trauma. Because the esophagus hardens and becomes brittle, often cracks and creates a stovepipe inflexibility, there is a reflux factor that causes all food and drink passing through it to be coughed back up. At times, these poor sufferers practically have to jump up and down to get the simplest foods to pass through their hardened esophagus and reach the digestive system. Working with Dr. Ivan Danoff, an extraordinary researcher from Dallas, and Dr. William Shanker of the Internal Medical Department at Southwestern Medical School, San Antonio, I was invited to participate in a test program for introducing lupus and scleroderma victims to the healing plant with applications of topical aloe cream and internal doses of aloe vera drinking gel. After personally introducing those two products to their support group, Dr. Shanker was particularly impressed with the aloe vera drinking gel's ability to lower their reflux resistance and actually enjoy relatively normal abilities to swallow food and liquid. So impressed was Dr. Shanker with those responses that he is proposing a double-blind study to be conducted under the auspices of Southwestern Medical School. First, however, Dr. Shanker will be conducting a preliminary efficacy and safety examination in which the volunteer group of patients to be studied will be given average daily doses of aloe vera. In 15 days and again in 30 days, the group will be monitored for blood analysis, urinalysis, electrocardiogram, and a host of other tests to establish aloe vera safety, efficacy, and consistency. Once that test is performed, a pro forma test for us, Dr. Shanker will take the results to the Southwestern Medical School Safety Review Board to get permission to conduct a double-blind study to determine aloe vera's positive effects on sufferers of these two dread diseases. It is just one of the many ways this silent healer is being made available to help these long-suffering people. We're happy to say there are more. Because of the work of Dr. Danoff, Dr. Shanker, and many other visionary MDs, more patients in need of the aloe's many healing capabilities will soon be able to benefit from them on a regular basis. Chapter 10, Stress Tests. Stress expresses itself in many forms, from breakdowns in the immune system to profound and prolonged ulceration. It is the penultimate expression of a system out of balance. In modern society, stress and often related substance addiction have so riddled our superstructure that everyone is looking for viable solutions. Occasionally, as is increasingly the case in science and medicine, relief and amelioration can come from a wide variety of sources, not the least of which are treatments with stabilized aloe vera. Ulcer protection, ulcer relief, and stress. Stress, the scourge of modern society, Before we take another step toward again proclaiming the seemingly limitless curative powers of aloe vera, we need to define stress and acknowledge the fact that in this highly advanced, low-touch techno-society into which we have been strata-launched in the last 10 years, in a society in which we have made medical breakthroughs in legion in the treatment of traditional diseases, stress has now emerged as health public enemy number one. Not surprisingly, recent studies have shown stress to be the primary situational cause of stroke, heart failure, hypertension, and other cardiovascular complications, as well as being highly contributory to certain types of cancer and gastrointestinal complications. Having made this somewhat apocalyptic proclamation, it is only fitting that we observe that there are various kinds of stress, not all of them bad. Earlier, we touched on a kind of stress called eustress. This refers to the kind of stress that's generated from positive energy in a reinforcing set of circumstances. You're at bat, bases loaded, two out, bottom of the ninth, last game of the World Series, and your team is down one run. That's an example of eustress. Working late because you're about to find a breakthrough cure for cancer, another example of eustress. Running for U.S. Senate, loving the campaign, leading by a slim margin, a classic example of eustress. Sure, it's tough, but think of the high. Playing the numbers, making $1 million a day on the stock market and feeling like one of the masters of the universe, this is an example of eustress at its highest possible expression. Positive, life-affirming, eustress is good. Eustress can even be great. Nobody ever died from an overdose of eustress. Or did they? There is that red line factor, that element of overdoing it, of pushing the envelope to the breaking point so that eustress kicks over into stress and stays there. That's where the fun stops and the telltale signs begin. Loss of appetite, insomnia, loss of libido, and an inability to concentrate, just to name a few. The other kind, stress through tension, situational stress through job pressures, overwork, extreme deadline pressures, lack of sleep, unhappy home or business circumstances, heavy travel schedules, improper diet and eating or drinking habits, even an unhealthy environment, all combine to various degrees to wreak incredible havoc on individuals and entire populations. Small wonder, then, that stress is considered to be the great negative byproduct of our overachieving modern society. Nor is it any longer a peculiarity of stereotypes. A recent Newsweek cover article, March 6, 1995, notes that, quote, the 1950s notion that had hard-driving type A character types having the most stress and heart attacks hasn't held up under scrutiny. But certain components of the type A personality have emerged as strong predictors of ill health. Studies have found, for example, that of self-absorption makes heart attacks more likely. Cynicism and hostility have the same effect. For all the value that psychotherapists once placed on expressing anger, recent research points to the fact that this exercise merely strengthens hostile feelings. They also acknowledge that there is no best recipe for managing stress, but anything that stills the mind will help. The challenge is that, other than its symptom byproducts such as exhaustion, fatigue, irritability, and anxiety, stress as a syndrome provides no measurable physical entity in and of itself until it is well advanced. And since its causes are more than occasionally intangible, it usually selects separate sets of symptoms with which to manifest. People under extreme stress, for example, will often exhibit elevated levels of LDL cholesterol, triglycerides, frequent occurrence of migraine headaches, and fatigue. In fact, for a long time, such maladies as chronic fatigue syndrome were believed, rather erroneously, to be the direct result of too much stress in a person's life. It would not be surprising to any professional reading this to hear that in my personal experience as both a pharmacist and an owner of several pharmaceutical product companies, the physicians and other medical practitioners I've worked with will invariably acknowledge stress as the single most contributory factor to the conditions they treat. A quick ballpark estimate would bring that figure to be true in about 80% of the cases, and some would take the estimate even higher. Of course, there are life-altering behavioral patterns that one can undertake to reduce stress, but these are often time-consuming, require life-altering behavioral adjustments, and offer nothing in the way of a magic bullet. That still leaves us with a question about what can be done effectively to deal with stress in the meantime, while these other behavior modifications are being initiated or merely just being taken into consideration. At this point, we would be remiss in failing to recall our earlier chapter, Arthritis, Anti-Aging, Addiction, and Answers, that in the well-directed Frank Burns control group study, aloe vera proved profoundly and at times dramatically effective in the successful test group treatment of such post-addictive side effects as depression, anxiety, anger, alterations in appetite, and sleep disturbances, many of the same behavioral aberrations experienced by people under extreme stress. In fact, the pressures of withdrawal from substance abuse would not be unlike stress experienced as a result of intense lifestyle pressures experienced by people with tough job schedules and excessive compulsive work habits. Keep in mind, the term workaholic has a modern-day connotation all its own, and the personality expressions and stresses are strikingly similar to the addicted personality. It's also not at all unusual to find people under extreme professional pressure to resort to some sort of substance abuse, such as cocaine or alcohol. That still leaves us to deal with the tissue trauma side effects of stress in physical manifestations such as ulceration, allergies, rashes, hypertension, elevated cholesterol, and even stroke. Barring the taking of antidepressants, mood enhancers, muscle relaxants, palliatives like Tagamet used to treat ulceration, and a more balanced lifestyle, all in the eye of the beholder, there hasn't been much in the way of reparative treatment for the symptoms of stress or physical means of helping one to cope with stress. We can easily show that ulcers of various kinds have been treated with remarkable success using raw aloe vera gel, stabilized aloe compounds from the gel, and extracts from the acemannan molecule. What we also intend to reveal are a pair of studies that show great promise for aloe vera as a systemic balancing agent and possible preventive of stress as we perceive it to be. Ulcers and ulcerative colitis. Ulcers are omnipresent. Any severe break in tissue which refuses to heal in a normal span of time is commonly referred to as an ulcer. Generally, in the healthy human system, ulcers caused by external trauma such as wounds, lesions, scrapes, and burns will heal in time and through healthy exposure to drying air and oxygen. Ulcerations in the mucous membranes are a different story. And ulcerations which are caused systemically, such as aphthous or mouth ulcers, stomach ulcers, and intestinal ulcers, tend to persist and can stay around for years, and more than occasionally can plague the sufferer to death. This is especially true of stomach, duodenal, colon, and intestinal cancers. In fact, these kinds of cancers have become so prevalent, it is now estimated that about 8% of the population will experience this form of ulceration during its lifetime. Again, in most cases, ulcers are self-limiting, and even in the mucous membranes, will heal by themselves in time. In the meantime, they can cause serious complications, including hemorrhaging, scarring, an obstruction to the normal passage of materials, and result in cancer. Once again, our animal friends help us prove how these ulcers work and how they may be treated successfully. Customarily, gastrointestinal ulcerations or erosions can be produced in animal models, rats in this case, by a variety of means, one of which involves restraining the creatures for extended periods of time. Since these artificial restraints rarely fail to prompt some kind of ulcerative condition in the animals in question, eventually these test models become excessively frustrated and develop erosions in the linings of their gastrointestinal systems. In 1979, one experiment by Egyptian research scientist Kendall Gobrin, Ph.D., reported a set of test ratios involving four groups of albino rats. By every measure of testing, if an albino rat is immobilized in a restrained environment for a period of 24 hours or more, the frustration of that immobilization causes erosions and even hemorrhages in the stomach. In the case of the Kendall-Gobrin studies, four groups were divided into test groups, each using different modalities of treatment, starting 12 hours before restraint. The findings of this test after the cycle was completed are worth noting.